What the Buddha really said is, you know, suffering is something to be understood. You know, aversion is a kind of suffering, you know. Impatience, ill will is a kind of suffering. It's something to be understood. And to understand something, we need to know it. So there is actually, I think, the very act of being willing to investigate those moments is actually an act of metta. You know, instead of just having those kind of blanket labels, you know, that this is irritation, this is frustration, to actually, what is aversion? How do I know the body of aversion? How do I know the kind of the wholeness of aversion? What does that feel like? How do I experience it? That's already establishing a dialogue with aversion, and that is metta. You know, it's not a particular emotional response, but it's that willingness to turn towards and to actually, that investigation is, in my mind, the befriending. Hmm? Yeah. I'm sure anyone who's been in this room, who's been a parent, will have some empathy with those moments. I think, you know, what we often really underestimate is the degree to which fatigue makes the mind vulnerable to difficult mental states. You know, we can have all the ideals in the world, you know, that we should be so patient and that we should be so understanding. But many people in our culture live in a chronic state of tiredness and overstretched. And, you know, there is nothing so prone to make the mind move into reactivity as actually being under-resourced. Being under-resourced inwardly. And, you know, this is a very difficult question in many people's lives, isn't it? Because we may know that to be true. And for some people, it may feel like there's very, very few choices around that being under-resourced. And, you know, this is a reality in some people's lives. But we also, I think, really, you know, when life can feel overfull in that way, I think it's a huge creative endeavor to actually look, not just for that moment when you arrive home and the kids are crazy, you know, but throughout the day. How do you resource yourself inwardly? How do you actually, you know, rather than feeling that this is some kind of, you know, life sentence of just, you know, running the wheel around, you know, a lot of this practice involves a huge amount of creativity about, you know, because we don't always have the power to actually totally change the nature of our life, our work, our responsibilities. But we may actually have far more options than we often appreciate to take that one moment of stopping, that one moment of rest, that one moment of coming back to the body, that one moment of actually practicing some of those qualities throughout our day rather than getting home and wondering why we're so stressed out. You know, we're stressed out because of how our life is, some of which is out of our control. And some of it we may be able to make a lot of just very, very small adjustments in. That when we arrive home, we don't arrive home just wait, you know, just feeling like there's another assault of need or demand or difficulty. There isn't an easy answer to this, you know, there isn't an easy answer to this. But I think it involves creativity more than anything else. You know, before when you arrive home, you know, do you actually, you know, is there a kind of habitual routine that everybody steps into, which is unhelpful? You know, kids argue, mum yells, you know. I mean, is there some sort of habitual, it's not just you involved in this, is there? It's often kind of family dynamics, I found, you know. So are there ways to kind of adjust that? Is there a way of taking, you know, rather than launching immediately into, I got to make dinner, I got to do this, is there a moment of actually sitting down quietly for 5 minutes for everybody together? You know, one really has to be creative with this. You know, let's all take some moments to breathe out here. You know, maybe my kids are all stressed out too for being in, you know, playgrounds and schools and, you know, childhood demands. You know, is there a way that we can collectively agree to even just take 2 minutes together of stopping? You know, so I really think it takes a lot of creativity because, you know, there's that parental guilt thing is such a wearying one, isn't it? You know, how I would wish to be and what I wish to embody for my family, and then finding ourselves, you know, turning into this kind of monster, you know, for moments. I know it's not unfamiliar to people, but we have to kind of like shift the routines often in order to break out of the habit patterns. You know, a lot of our habit patterns, not just emotional and psychological, they're behavioral too. You know, they're behavioral too. You know, and sometimes making those little adjustments, you know, it kind of opens up that doorway, like, oh, well, maybe there's a different way of responding here. Because I mean, the guilt is obviously not helpful, but it's also a messenger, isn't it? That's sometimes saying, you know, I really am kind of like there's a certain dissonance in my life. You know, there's a dissonance between my aspirations and my values and my intentions and what gets embodied. And dissonance is uncomfortable for all of us, but it's also the classroom of our path, dissonance. You know, so it's kind of like being able to listen to those voices as a kind of messenger rather than just as a shaming, berating, almost setting up the conditions for the next moment of tension. Creativity. And how are you relating that to the sense doors?
Well, you know, perhaps.
Did you hear the question?
Yeah.
It says, okay, so this relationship between receptivity and choice, discernment. But I'm curious how you're relating that to how the sense doors are used. Okay, so it's a question about guarding and not guarding the sense doors. And, you know, this is a very, very teaching that's continued a lot in the text around guarding the sense doors. And it's really important to remember that includes the mind, you know. So it's not just eyes, ears, body, touch, taste, and it really includes the mind. So there's a lot of emphasis in the teachings around guarding the sense doors because, you know, it's kind of like we're not invulnerable to the world of impressions. You know, I mean, if you sat at a computer and watch pornography all day, it's going to do something to your mind. You know, it's going to do something to your reactions. You know, so, you know, there is this discernment quality, which is, you know, so essential in the fabric of mindfulness about what is skillful, what is unskillful, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. This is not a kind of right, wrong, good, bad, but about where it goes. So, you know, clearly there's a huge emphasis upon cultivating the wholesome, and being aware of our relationship to the unwholesome, you know, where that is kind of sought out, pursued, you know. So guarding the sense doors has part of it is that discernment, you know. What is it useful for us to actually cultivate, and what is useful for us to avoid, to not pursue? protecting, self-protection is about fear. And I think of that as different than guarding. I think of self-protection as this kind of closing down out of anxiety and not allowing, you know, and just living in that contracted space. Guarding the sense doors, I think of as an act of discernment. And I think this also includes what goes on in our mind because, you know, I was talking a little bit about the judgmental pattern that happens so often for people. And it's really a habit pattern. And there's some way about, you know, how to guard the mind in a skillful way. I mean, the Buddha once put it, you know, he said, I can think of nothing that does so much harm as an untrained mind. And I can think of nothing that can be such a great friend as a well-trained mind and heart. You know? And some of those habit patterns are really, you know, the kind of manifestation of that untrained mind, you know, that they almost have a life of their own. And sometimes it's useful just to stop them. You know? I mean, it sometimes feels like there's no choices, but I think the moment that we bring some mindfulness into these areas of habit patterns, there are choices. I mean, say you see some judgmental story starting to arise and you've been around that loop a million times. You know, maybe it's time just to stop it. You know, and the Buddha wasn't exactly always that kind of gentle around the kind of effort that's needed to do that. He said, you know, if you see something arising, every drop of insight has been squeezed out. It's only going to lead to suffering. He says, why not just press your tongue against your roof of your mouth and don't go there? A kinder way would be to use metta. Would be to use metta just as an intervention. Interrupt the momentum of habits that don't serve us well. I mean, I think in effort, you know, there's these two pieces of receptivity and agency. These two go together. You know, a lot of it within the practice, within the development of attention and effort, is about learning how to receive, how to listen, how to attune to what is. But there's this other part of effort, which is about agency. It's about making choices, about acting upon discernments. And I think in an ideal world of wise effort, these two are not separate. They're not separate. Yeah, there's two ways in which abandonment is used. I mean, in the text, abandonment is used as a virtue. It's a very noble quality. It's a very wholesome quality. Abandoning the unwholesome, abandoning the unskillful. So it's not considered to be an act of aversion. It's an application of discernment. It's an application of insight. The way that I was using abandonment earlier on in my discussion was more as an act of aversion, the way that we just, you know, dismiss, disconnect. So it's very important to see those differences in the two ways of using the word abandonment. I mean, I think a lot of people have some trouble with the kind of textual use of that word because they're more familiar with the abandonment of aversion. So it sounds like almost like a prescription for aversion, but it's not. It's simply disenchantment. It's really disenchantment. Yeah. It's a little bit, you know, it's not so different than investigating aversion. They're not that different, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's very understandable at times. But, you know, I would almost think of it, you know, sometimes when I work with people, for example, who have chronic pain, you know, the pattern, understandably, of abandonment is very strong because it's all just a bit too much. Mm-hmm. And very often I would suggest to people, well, you know, you mustn't turn either metta or mindfulness into a sort of command structure that says, you know, I have to stay with this, you know, or, you know, because that just turns it into endurance. It doesn't turn it into mindfulness. So you always have to allow yourself a lot of flexibility of exploration. When I work with people with chronic pain, you know, I wouldn't say to somebody, you know, stay with it, stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. Because again, this actually is just a way of depleting resources. Eventually you will become exhausted by staying with the difficult, and then there will be overwhelm. And I've never found that there's much value that comes out of overwhelm. So say with chronic pain, I would suggest to somebody, you know, find one place in your body that is not in pain. Touch your lips together. Earlobes are great. The palms of your hands. Move between what is painful or the body of fear to that which is quite neutral, to that which is not touched. Move between. Keep your attention very fluid, because what you see with difficult mental states is the attention becomes very rigid and very contracted, as if there's nothing outside of that difficult emotion or that difficult mental space. In truth, there's much that's outside of that difficult emotion or mental state. And it's really important to cultivate the fluidity rather than getting stuck in the kind of rigidity of it. You know, and you know, one of the kind of, you know, efforts that the Buddha speaks about is, you know, take your attention elsewhere. Check in with the rest of your world. Ah, you know, there's fear. Oh, I'm still seeing this in front of me. You know, there's fear. Ah, sounds are still happening. Ah, there's fear. There's this place in my body that's quite neutral. So keeping the attention fluid is actually, I think, really critical. Because, you know, the kind of like the magnetism of difficult mental states or chronic pain, for example, is one just gets sucked in and the world contracts and you kind of lost the rest of the moment. And I think part of mindfulness and part of wise effort is reclaiming that which has been lost in the face of very difficult emotions and mental states. And that takes really a conscious effort. But simply by doing that, by even checking in with the rest of your sense doors, for example, you know, your eyes, your ears, you're actually sort of beginning to kind of loosen the kind of rigidity of that identification. And it's almost like reclaiming a slightly more expanded world. Yes, definitely don't turn mindfulness into a command structure. It's knowing, there's a lot of times of the wisdom of knowing when to be with and when to step away from. And, you know, stepping away from is not abandonment. It's not saying not this, not ever. It's actually just saying not this, not now. Out of a recognition that kind of inner resourcing feels very depleted. You don't need to worry that you've missed that one golden moment to meet fear. It will wait for you when you come back. Liz.
So is it corollary of that, that this cultivation that we've been talking about, is it that you would be cultivating metta a lot in times that are either neutral or positive, so that it's there when you need it?
Yeah.
Because I've never thought about it that way, but it seems, if it were biddable when you were under-resourced, which some of us spend a lot of time in that state, and you know, you feel irritable and cranky, if you had it there, if it were sort of biddable, it just seems like, but I never sort of made that distinction that you could cultivate it when things are okay. I mean, I obviously I've thought about that.
I think it would be probably not so useful to think of metta as an emergency measure. it's probably not going to be very effective. You know, I think it is an inclination that is cultivated in such an ongoing way that it is available in those, you know, in those moments when actually a refuge is really needed. You know, and a kind of a place of refuge is really needed, and that's not built in moments of crisis or moments of being under-resourced. Is the degree to which you've been cultivated in other places. Yes. Yes. Yes.
The only option would be to have distance, but the other person doesn't get the message, and so you feel like you're doing something really horrible to them by rejecting them in some way. So it's getting to this impasse of communication, and then feeling guilty about the feeling of rejection of that person.
Yeah, I recap it. Yeah. So the question is, what is the place of metta in that?
Yeah.
So I'm sure this is a situation many people can actually feel familiar with, you know, in close relationships where perhaps one person is changing, the other person is not, and you reach a kind of impasse of communication, and you don't feel like this is actually going to develop or flourish. Or it's actually, and yet to leave it, it can often feel very hurtful to the other person, of course, and, you know, being having some actually impulses of wholesomeness within yourself, you feel bad that another person is hurt, and of course we feel bad when another person is hurt. Guilt may be something extra, maybe optional, but feeling sad when another person is hurt is very human and actually quite noble. You know, close relationships, whether they're partner relationships or they're family relationships, clearly these are the places where there can be the strongest love and also the strongest dysfunction. You know, it's almost easier to feel metta, embrace a stranger with metta than people who are really near to us, because then we've got the complexity of our stories and our histories and our investments in one another. You have to see when a relationship is no longer thriving. You have to question what's being fed by continuing it. And by ending it, it doesn't have to be out of aversion. It's because we're not thriving together. In fact, we may be doing something much worse, of hurting one another. And, you know, it's always a difficult thing, isn't it, to really realize the limits, to actually change the course of another person's mind or heart. It's a really hard one to accept for us, you know. We think, you know, well, we're doing our best here, you know. And why aren't you hearing me? You know, or, you know, we're kind of making all these good ideas. Why aren't you kind of just coming along for the journey? You know, it's really hard for us to accept the limit of our powers to actually change the heart or mind of another, even though we would much more easily accept the limits of another person's power to change our mind and heart. You know, we would easily accept that. We say, no, another person's not going to change me. You know, I realize they can't do that. But somehow we still, I think, out of care and out of affection, we still kind of sign up for that one, that we should have more power to change the heart and mind of another person than we do. There are some wonderful equanimity phrases that I'll just throw out to end with, and they might be something to useful to reflect on. It's from a Sri Lankan text. It says, you know, life is a play of joy and sorrow. May I remain unshaken by life's rise and fall. I care for you deeply, but you are the parent of your acts and their consequences, and sadly I cannot protect you from distress. There's something quite powerful in that. You know, we can care for another deeply, but sadly we cannot always protect them from distress, because the ways of their heart and mind, in a sense, are truly in their hands and not in ours. So we can't always, you know, protect someone from, if they feel rejected or if they feel, you know, forsaken, even when it's not in our intentions at all. But we can't always protect someone from distress. Okay, I think that's the place we need to end. Liz just has a couple of announcements.